News. I'm Gene Randall. Afghanistan's presidential election is underway, and there has been violence in the wake of the Taliban warning to Afghan voters to stay home. AP correspondent Sarah Bassett has a report.
An upsurge in violence in the run-up to the elections following the collapse of U.S. Taliban talks to end America's longest war had already rattled Afghanistan. Yet many voters expressed frustration over government corruption and chaos at polling stations, such as incomplete voters' lists and unworkable biometric ID systems. Reports of violence emerged from southern Afghanistan, the former spiritual heartland of the Taliban. A bomb attack on a local mosque where a polling station was located wounded 15 people. Elections in Afghanistan are notoriously flawed. In the last presidential polls in 2014, allegations of widespread corruption were so massive that the United States intervened. No winner was declared, and the U.S. cobbled together a unity government. I'm Sarah Bassett.
The latest in the impeachment investigation of U.S. President Donald Trump. House Democrats have issued a document subpoena to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Pompeo has missed two earlier document deadlines. The Washington Post and the New York Times both report Mr. Trump's special representative for Ukraine has quit. Kurt Volker was named in the whistleblower complaint that the president pressured Ukraine's chief executive for help in an effort to tarnish the reputation of Democratic presidential hopeful Joe Biden. And Mr. Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, told Sky News that along with his client, he had done nothing wrong.
What I did is perfectly lawful, perfectly legal. I find it completely extraordinary that you're spending all this time asking me about what I did. All this time should be spent on the pay-for-play scheme that Biden set up, in which he made millions and millions of dollars.
To stay up to date on all the day's news, you can always go to our website, voanews.com. There is also a convenient, easy-to-use mobile app. From Washington, this is VOA News. The United Nations is rushing to provide aid to hundreds of thousands of people affected by severe flooding in Niger. The heavy rains, which began in June, have killed scores of people and affected more than 200,000. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports the situation took a dramatic turn for the worse the last week of August. That was when water levels of the Niger Basin reached flood stage and overflow from dams in neighboring Burkina Faso and Mali contributed to the surging waters. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says the last time the Niger Basin reached this level was in 2012.
At that time, the floods left dozens of dead and affected nearly 500,000 people. Each year, there has been an upward trend in how many people are affected by these seasonal rains. We have seen a doubling of the number of people affected since 2015, as well as increasing material damage, including destruction of crops and loss of livestock.
Lisa Schlein filed that report for VOA from Geneva. One of the most prominent Hong Kong pro-democracy activists says he plans to go into elective politics in China's semi-autonomous territory. Joshua Wong made the announcement today, saying he would run in November's district council election.
Frankly speaking, run for office is the most moderate, peaceful, and rational way to express our political belief. If they block young activists just like me to run for office, they need to pay the price.
Back here in the United States, consumer spending, a key economic indicator, was up last month, but not by much. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports the August numbers may raise further concerns for the American economy and what may lie ahead.
American consumers boosted their spending just 0.1% in August. It's the smallest gain in 6 months, despite incomes growing at a solid pace. The Commerce Department says personal income was up 0.4% last month. That boosted the savings rate to 8.1%, a sign that consumers aren't overspending. Consumers are a key driver of the economy as businesses have cut their investment spending and exports have slipped. Last month's modest gain follows several months of healthy increases in consumer spending, with consumer confidence at historically high levels. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Joseph Wilson, the former ambassador who disputed U.S. intelligence on Iraq that was used to justify going to war under President George W. Bush, has died. He was 69. Wilson died of organ failure in Santa Fe, New Mexico. That word from his former wife, Valerie Plame, whose identity as a CIA operative was exposed in 2003, just days after Wilson's criticism of reports that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein was trying to purchase uranium in Africa. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote is away on assignment.
At that time, the floods left dozens of dead and affected nearly 500,000 people. Each year, there has been an upward trend in how many people are affected by these seasonal rains. We have seen a doubling of the number of people affected since 2015.
Hundreds of thousands of people affected by severe flooding in Niger in need of urgent help.
In many of my discussions with victims of excessive use of force by police, those victims related that they were targeted because they belonged to opposition party.
A UN special rapporteur ends a 10-day visit to Zimbabwe to assess the human rights situation and calls for dialogue to clear a toxic environment in the southern African country.
We thought that it would give us an opportunity to basically shine a light on diversity of words and diversity of meanings that are part of African politics, even though they're in, you know, very frequent use in contemporary Africa to describe changing political dynamics.
And a new online dictionary of African politics is published. Those are then more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Zimbabwe's former president, Robert Mugabe, was buried Saturday at a low-key event in his rural village. The site was chosen after the 95-year-old former leader's family refused to have him buried at the National Shrine in Harare because he had been ridiculed. As Columbus Mavinga reports for VOA, Zimbabwe's ruling party is not happy about that.
Christo, Christo, Christo.
A Roman Catholic Mass was held Saturday afternoon at the home of former Zimbabwean leader Robert Mugabe, about 100 kilometers southwest of Harare, before his burial. Only family members were allowed to witness the actual burial, which took place at his home just before sunset. Junior Shuvai Gumbochuma, the sister of Grace Mugabe, said the former leader's family was not worried about the low-key burial.
Noku ziva greatness yangaina baba vamugabe.
She says, we might be surprised by the way Mugabe was a great man and then see the number of people who gathered here to bury him. I remember when he used to bury other heroes at the National Heroes Acam, buses coming from all corners of the country, coming to bury other heroes, but in our minds, we were expecting his burial to be more special than other heroes' burials because of who he was. Let me tell you that what we have done today was his wish, because he said it with his own mouth, that he does not want to be buried at the National Heroes Acam. So we thank God, even if his burial may look small with small number of people, we are happy that we honored his wishes. He said, I will not be buried at the National Heroes Acam. I was ridiculed. She did not explain further. Mugabe died in Singapore after a long illness, which his successor, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, later said was cancer. Initially, Mugabe was expected to be buried at the National Shrine in Harare until Thursday, when his family took the body to his rural home where he was born in 1924, grew up, learned there, and taught before he started his political career. Love Momaduke, a law professor and analyst, comments on the Mugabe family's decision to snub the National Shrine where a mausoleum was being built for him.
Yeah, well, I was very surprised because when the idea came that he would be separated from the rest of the heroes and be given a special place, I thought that was really the most fitting way of burying President Robert Mugabe. So when the decision was then made, I think, yeah, we were really surprised.
And as an analyst, why do you think that this could be happening?
Well, I am convinced that it has to do with his last wishes. I'm sure he emphasized the point.
Why would I want to be buried here and not where others are being buried?
Oh, I mean, you cannot say run away from the fact that it is related to the coup in November 2017. Certainly, the way it started, 1980 as Prime Minister, then 1987 as the President, and then going all the way, you would not have expected President Mugabe to leave office at the instance of his own colleagues. So I think that whereas most of us had forgiven that process and that we are moving forward, one would have to understand that he might not have been able to move away from that very point.
After his nearly 40 years in power, Mugabe was ousted by the army in 2017 and replaced by his ally of over 50 years, President Mnangagwa. On Saturday, ruling ZANU-PF party spokesman Simon Kayamo said the Mugabe's family decision to bury Zimbabwe's former leader at his Rua village was most unfortunate, adding that with the construction of the mausoleum progressing within the defined time frame, all patriotic Zimbabweans were shocked to learn that the remains of the former president had been secretly taken yesterday to Zvimba for a private burial on Saturday. We indeed respect wishes of families of deceased heroes, hence get saddened when maneuvers that border on political gimmicks begin to unfold on an issue concerning an illustrious liberation icon. One can even say in death, Mugabe's controversy lingers on. During his time in office, he was accused of unleashing death squads to quash the opposition, election rigging, human rights abuses, and mismanaging the economy of Zimbabwe, the country he had led to liberation from colonialism against Great Britain. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Zvimba, Zimbabwe.
UN agencies are rushing to provide aid to hundreds of thousands of people affected by severe flooding in Niger. The heavy rains, which began in June, have killed 57 people and affected 211,000. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Niger is facing multiple emergencies. The floods are just adding to the crises already stretching the capacity of the government and humanitarian agencies to respond. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports the situation took a dramatic turn for the worse the last week of August. That was when water levels of the Niger Basin reached flood stage and overflow from dams in neighboring Burkina Faso and Mali contributed to the surging waters. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says the last time the Niger Basin reached this level was in 2012.
At that time, the floods left dozens of dead and affected nearly 500,000 people. Each year, there has been an upward trend in how many people are affected by these seasonal rains. We have seen a doubling of the number of people affected since 2015, as well as increasing material damage, including destruction of crops and loss of livestock.
The hardest hit regions are Zinder, Maradi, and Agadez. The UN reports more than 16,000 houses have been damaged, rendering tens of thousands of people homeless. The UN Children's Fund says an estimated 123,000 children are directly affected by the floods. Spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says children are the most vulnerable to respiratory infections, waterborne diseases, and a host of other problems.
The children in Niger face malnutrition, recurrent disease, epidemics and outbreaks, cyclical floods, drought, and displacement. This, of course, is exacerbated by the instability in neighboring countries. We have now an influx of thousands of refugees, returnees, and migrants, all of whom are in need of basic social services for survival.
The UN cites priority needs as shelter, non-food items, food, water, sanitation, and hygiene supplies. Humanitarian agencies warn they are having difficulty meeting the urgent needs because of serious underfunding. For instance, OCHA says it only has received 37% of its $380 million appeal. It says that is not enough to care for the 2.3 million people in need of aid in Niger, half of them children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As the world's policymakers, diplomats, and others converged in New York this week for the annual opening of the UN General Assembly, one fact remained grimly apparent. Violence and extremism continue to thrive. That is why anticipating and stabilizing conflict is a key mission for the U.S. State Department, which is charged with promoting and protecting America's interests around the world. To find out more about some of the Bureau's operations, especially in Africa, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Denise Natali, the State Department's Assistant Secretary at the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations. Natali began by stating the Bureau's complex mission in the simplest terms.
Our mission is to anticipate, prevent, and respond to conflict that undermines U.S. national interests.
When you talk about protecting and furthering the U.S. national interest, what's your working understanding of what that is?
One of the important documents when we determine what's our national interest, I look at our national security strategy. A component of our national security strategy is to look at where we can take preventative action so that we can prevent terrorism and violent extremism that can then affect homeland, our allies, our assets, our personnel overseas. I mean, when our allies are also affected, we also have our national interests there, because then you can lead to, you know, massive refugee flows, massive effects on international markets, or wherever it may be. How do we do this? We deploy our team out to conflict zones. And we also use data analytics to form the predictive measures so that we can better target the assistance that we have.
What do you mean by the term data analytics?
We use evidence-based analysis to help us determine how do we devise programs, how do we be agile when we make foreign policy, how do we know that the problems that we think we're seeing are actually reflecting conflict trends that we measure. If we don't have those kinds of predictive capabilities, we're essentially acting by our gut. So we have to be very local, we have to be very specific, and that's what I mean when I say we have these analytics to help us get more focused.
Tell me about the conflict stabilization piece.
But stabilization is essentially a shorter term endeavor than, let's say, development. So it's essentially a political endeavor. It should be driven and work with legitimate local partners to set conditions so that locally legitimate actors can establish, stabilize regions, and then move forward to do longer term work.
Please tell me more specifically about the work that your bureau does in Africa.
One of the areas that we work on is what we call defections. How do you get former terrorist fighters to defect from their organization and reintegrate into society? It's a huge question in places like Niger or the Lake Chad Basin or Nigeria, whether that be Boko Haram, ISIS West Africa, that are there, and certain members of them may want to defect. So we have a program where we work with our counterparts in Niger, the government of Niger, and local groups to encourage Boko Haram fighters through messaging to defect. They become de-radicalized in a de-radicalization center, and then working with USAID partners, and over time, they can be encouraged to reintegrate back into their communities. We had some successes in working with the government of Niger to even create a strategy, a national action plan for the first time to even address this issue, which is a really big issue. It took about 2 years with other local actors, with other local NGOs and our partners to get the government of Niger to understand that you have to have some kind of plan that puts a legal framework in place. That was a very positive step forward.
I know after that national plan was put in place, you and a delegation traveled to pretty remote parts of Niger, where Boko Haram had once been very strong, to get the locals on board with this.
Many of the ex-Boko Haram fighters were not ideologically or religiously motivated in the first place.
Yes, you see this very dire situation in a country that has sparse resources where some of the people said they joined Boko Haram because they needed 2 phone cards, or I joined Boko Haram because I needed gas for my motorcycle. And it's a really long deliberative process that took 2 years for some of the aid workers to sensitize the local communities to even think about asking them to come back. So you have different categories so that the society can understand, not everybody's all the same. And then you move forward. So you asked me what we're doing in Africa. That's one issue, looking at fragile states and determining how we can always be ahead of the curve.
Denise Natali is Assistant Secretary at the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations at the U.S. State Department. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in conjunction with the opening of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. When Special Rapporteur Clement Valu on Friday ended a 10-day visit to Zimbabwe to assess the human rights situation and called for dialogue to clear what he called a toxic environment in the southern African country. The visit took place at a time when rights groups are worried about the abductions of activists, the most prominent case being a doctor who left the country for medical treatment after he was allegedly kidnapped and poisoned. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare for VOA.
This is the first official visit by an independent human rights expert to Zimbabwe, where for years rights groups have accused the government security forces and ruling party thugs of beating, torturing and killing opponents. Clement Valu was appointed by the UN Human Rights Council, explained to VOA what he meant by the toxic environment he had observed during his 10-day visit to Zimbabwe.
Toxic environments. I raised this many times in many of my meetings with the government authorities. And also that there is this kind of general fear and this polarization and the lack of trust is something that also have impact on the enjoyment of the right for freedom of association, peaceful assembly. In many of my discussion with victims of excessive use of force by police, those victims related that they were targeted because they belonged to opposition party.
The Togolese National Call for a Political Dialogue between Political Leaders and Civil Society, which he said would result in the peace, human dignity and economic recovery of Zimbabwe. He said authorities should investigate the ongoing spate of kidnappings and disappearance of activists. The opposition blames state security forces for the abductions, although the government denies involvement. Dr. Peter Magombeyi, the leader of an ongoing doctor strike, flew to South Africa on Thursday for medical treatment after allegedly being poisoned during a 5-day abduction last week. 37-year-old Tatenda Mombearara is recovering after being assaulted while detained in August for help organizing anti-government protests. He says he was detained, tortured and left for dead, only to be picked up by a good Samaritan who took him to a hospital. Despite that ordeal, Mombearara welcomes Valero's call for a dialogue.
Dialogue will help to build trust, to strengthen institutions, will help towards establishing the social contract which had broken down, which premises the origin of this crisis.
On Friday, Zimbabwe's Justice Minister, Ziyambi Ziyambi, told VOA that he was yet to see Valero's report. Valeu will present his final report on his findings in June of next year to the UN Human Rights Council, but he has hope for Zimbabwe.
I understand the complex situation in which Zimbabwe is going through. Yes, political competition is important, but the well-being of our communities are more important. Political leaders need to be brave enough to really sit on the around the table and discuss about the future of this country. And I believe that we will have new Zimbabwe which respects human rights, which provide minimum for its citizens.
It remains to be seen how President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government will react to the UN Special Rapporteur's report in which Valeu called for Harare to loosen its grip on anti-government protests, among other things. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Up and down the continent, African politics sees more than its share of chaos and corruption. Colorful terms and phrases describe the unfolding developments and sometimes make fun of them. A new online dictionary of African politics, published by Oxford University Press, tries to define these words. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Across Africa, people repurpose words for their daily lives to describe the political developments that, for better or worse, shape or at least influence their lives. In Nigeria, the term zoning has nothing to do with buildings or real estate. It describes power sharing between the north and south. In Kenya, three-piece suit refers to a party asking voters to back its full slate of candidates for president, governor, and member of parliament. In Kenya, three-piece suit refers to a party asking voters to back its full slate of candidates for president, governor, and member of parliament. It is a language that needs a dictionary, so thought one of the authors, Said Husseini, a student at Oxford University.
We thought that it would give us an opportunity to basically shine a light on the diversity of words and diversity of meanings that are part of African politics that might not have been recognized, even though they're in, you know, very frequent use in contemporary Africa to describe changing political dynamics. So it seemed like a good opportunity to just shine a light on, I guess, the fact that there's a lot of meaning that is being generated, a lot of new content, words like stomach infrastructure, you know, new political concepts that help us understand how Africa conducts the contemporary politics.
The term stomach infrastructure was coined by a politician in the 2015 elections in Nigeria. He promised people rice and chicken over development and won that election. In Benin, switching political party by politicians, it is called transhumance, which means an act of moving animals from one grazing ground to another. In Ghana, supporting the president of one party and a member of parliament from another party is called skirt and blouse voting. Another Kenyan term is negotiated democracy, which means the arranged sharing of power between communities before an election takes place. Kimani Njogu, an African linguist, says people create and use such terms everywhere, an act of what he calls semantic expansion.
It brings in a certain playfulness in our politics, a certain humor, a certain ingenuity, a certain relaxation of atmosphere and normalization. One could talk about a normalization of the politics so that it's not seen to be too removed from the day-to-day experiences of people.
Former Kenyan Prime Minister Raila Odinga has seen this type of language throughout his long career.
It is not that they are being simplistic about complex issues. It's just that they want to make it light. You know, sometimes they want to crack jokes about some of those issues. But I think it is a way of expression that, in one hand, tells you it is not right, but also with a light touch. So I think that is part of the African culture.
The Oxford Dictionary on Political Languages cover 350 words overly used in Africa since the introduction of multi-party democracy more than three decades ago. Njogu says the dictionary will change over the time as old expressions lose their usefulness and people create new ones to comment on their politics. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is the Voice of America and you are listening to Nightline Africa, and coming up in the second half of the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. But first, modern day slavery, human trafficking and bonded labor are among the cruelest of the global ills that policymakers, diplomats and NGOs have had to grapple with as the UN General Assembly convened in New York this week. Indeed, there are an estimated 40 million enslaved people around the world, a huge percentage of whom are Africans. To find out more about the reality of modern slavery on the continent, its many causes and possible remedies, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Nick Grono, CEO of the Freedom Fund, a global NGO based in London that partners with governments, NGOs and local communities to end this scourge of slavery and exploitation.
Africa is one of the regions with the highest percentage of people being enslaved in forced labor and bonded labor and all the rest of it. There's an estimated 9 million people across Africa out of a worldwide total of about 40 million. And it takes many forms. In Ghana, it's kids being forced to work in Lake Volta to do the fishing. They often get trapped in nets. There's very high incidence of injuries and appalling outcomes there. In Congo, we see terrible, terrible pictures and images of boys being forced to work in these deeply unsafe mines to pull out coltan, which is a mineral that powers our mineral phones. You have women desperately seeking a better future, migrating from Nigeria, being trafficked across the Mediterranean, ending up as sex slaves in southern Europe. You have child soldiers in Central African Republic.
How can governments actually permit this?
The fact is that slavery is illegal in every country in the world, and therefore governments should be enforcing their own laws and we would have no slavery. And sadly, that's not the case, which is why it's so important to also work with local communities themselves to help them understand what's going on. And the basic model is to work with local communities that are home to those that are being trafficked and exploited, to make them aware of the risks and their rights, to work with local NGOs that can give them better understanding and protection and services. It's basically bringing people together so that they can resist the exploitation they might otherwise be subject to. We've just done some studies in India working with communities where men, women and children are in bonded labour in brick kilns and stone quarries. And we've found through this community-based approach that the level of exploitation has been reduced from over 50% of the community in bonded labour down to about 12 or 13% over the period of 3 years.
Why do people agree to leave their families and communities in the first place?
Usually what it is desperate people making choices, and they only have very bad options to choose from. So for instance, in Ethiopia, if you're a young woman from a rural community, you have very few options in terms of getting a job. There is lots of community pressure on you to actually go overseas and earn income and send it back to support your family, right? And if you get a job and you work in a household that treats you reasonably well in the Middle East, that's not a bad outcome. The trouble is that more often than not, what actually happens is you're sent into a horrendous situation, your phone is taken away from you, you're not allowed out of the household. The workloads are usually a lot higher than were promised, so you end up working 18-hour days, and then there's always a very significant risk of being sexually assaulted by males in the household. So that's the reality. Now, you have to accept that people will migrate in search of a better lifestyle, so the solution is not to say, don't migrate. The solution is to say you have options and there are ways that you can make choices that will give you a better outcome. For instance, if you speak some Arabic, you will probably have a much better chance of having a better outcome in the Middle East. If you have a basic understanding of the environment you'll end up in, when we go to rural Ethiopia, say Amhara, where a lot of the girls come from, these girls and young women have never operated electrical equipment before. So they have no access to electricity. But if they end up in a large household in Saudi Arabia, they will be operating washing machines and irons and vacuum cleaners. And if they don't know how to do it, then chances are they're going to be subject to beatings and other forms of punishment. So even educating people about the basics of domestic work overseas, basic language skills, can make a big difference.
I can only imagine the emotional toll that this takes for the people at the Freedom Fund as you do this work.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think everyone that works closely in this space finds it tremendously difficult. What keeps, certainly in my organization, all of us going is we see a trajectory where we are making a huge difference. It's never an utter transformation. It's moving people from an utterly exploitative situation into a less bad situation, but one where they have a greater degree of freedom and choice. But we've got a long, long way to go.
That was Nick Grono, CEO of the Freedom Fund, an anti-slavery NGO based in London. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
The closure of the world's largest travel firm and airline, Thomas Cook, is causing panic in the Gambia's tourism industry. Thomas Cook was the major airline transporting tourists from the United Kingdom to the Gambia. The company declared bankruptcy a few weeks ago, which left tens of thousands of its customers stranded. Now the Gambian government says it has plans to help mitigate any possible delays for tourists visiting the West African nation this year. English to Africa reporter Pandeli Mbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Tourism Minister Hamad Ba recently held an emergency meeting of stakeholders in response to the closure of Thomas Cook, Gambia's largest tourism travel partner. The government says the meeting was aimed at mitigating what it called a possible job market failure and the impact the Thomas Cook closure could have caused to Gambia's economy. Besides agriculture, tourism is the backbone of Gambia's economy. It creates employment and massively contributes towards the nation's gross domestic product, GDP. The United Kingdom is also an important tourism partner to the Gambia. 30% of Gambia's tourists come from the UK. Malik Sow has been working in Gambia's tourism sector for many years. He says that the closure of Thomas Cook is going to hurt the country's economy if a replacement for the airline is not found.
It is going to have a real impact in our economy and even our tour guide market, because according to statistics, about 20% of our GDP is held by the tourism. And not only that, but even the tour market inside the Gambia, the tour guide market, about 70% of it used to be Thomas Cook tourist people that Thomas Cook used to bring into the Gambia.
Thousands of Thomas Cook customers were stranded following its closure. The UK government even had to intervene to help airlift the stranded customers.
Speaking to even some of my friends, since it happened, in fact, yesterday I was on the phone with one of them from the UK. But what she told me was that a lot of people already have deviated or they've cancelled their flight ticket and they're trying to get back their monies.
Gambia's tourist season is going to start in a few weeks. Hotel workers and other stakeholders are increasingly worried. They are concerned about the security of their jobs. Thomas Cook used to have a strong operational presence in Banjul. So commends the government for its timely intervention.
The Minister of Tourism was quick to react or summon all the stakeholders and other partners in the tourism development. So they promised that they are going to do whatever they can to make sure that all these things are sorted out.
Also affected by the Thomas Cook closure is Njaga Jammeh, a music promoter.
I was also expecting some of my guests from UK. I already make all of my bookings. Unfortunately, I get word from them that things are not on the proper side of it.
Gambian activist Pa Samba Jao is not happy with the government's press statement on the Thomas Cook closure. He says the statement is spin and lacks clarity. He asked that the government did not clearly state which airline company was going to replace Thomas Cook.
To suggest that the government has found a solution but could not provide any concrete answers to that solution or evidence to that solution, I think is really disappointing. And the reason why I'm saying that here is tourism is supposed to be starting in a few weeks in the Gambia.
Jao says the government should be honest with Gambians and come up with a convincing statement that will reassure stakeholders. He warns that failure to find a replacement for Thomas Cook could adversely affect Gambia's economy.
This Thomas Cook issue is not only about flights, because there are some hotels that I understand Thomas Cook has stakes in. How will those hotels be affected in the Gambia? And there are also other carriers that are part of the Thomas Cook family. How are those carriers going to be affected?
Thomas Cook was one of the cheapest flights from the UK to the Gambia compared to the other flights. Gambians living in the UK used to travel home with the airline for vacation. Many hope a replacement airline can be found that is as convenient and inexpensive. For VOA Africa, this is Pande Rimbai reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
It's now time for our Saturday Boys music sport. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great African music.
kudekeza kama mtoto Fura unaburahia Napo geuka moto Machozi mwilia We mama mungene Wena pesa kama Dangote Naweza nichayo msiki Naweza fenda mkuyo yote Penzi sio somo Kasome kwa kitabu Penzi mefanya harmonize Fukuzi shengwarabu Penzi yoyo Nimeleta kwa wanangu vita Squeezy sio Naishia kwa like it is Saivo Sio kupenda achana nani Nekupenda penda nanai Mambo sesi ayo bada Emucheza ufurai Kama songi limekole Azalina manju Je t'aime Balou baba te kaou Balou baba te kaou Nala kole mette Balou baba te kaou Balou baba te kaou Nala kole mette Shina nata kito Vena nata yelengito Shina nata kito Vena nata yelengito Kwa l'amour est compliqué Chérie moi toujours romantique Asa yinama
Tarama na bakoti mulungu,
mabosi mulungu.
Tarama na bala lili.
volvas pronto. Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi. Paquita, fidele yo, te volvas pronto. Paquita, para bien, que tu madre te garda. Oh, estoy a tu espera, quiero que creces pronto. Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi. Paquita, fidele yo, te volvas pronto. Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi. Paquita, fidele yo, te volvas pronto.
Mi amor, de tu madre te garda. Estoy a tu espera, quiero que creces pronto.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, we thank you for joining us tonight and hope you join us again tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Impoga.
This is VOA News. I'm David Byrne.